New research shows mass shooters have a lot in common. The findings could be used to help prevent future attacks. The Violence Project has studied every U.S. mass shooting since 1966. Its database, which is not publicly available yet, includes 160 mass shooters who have killed four or more people in a public place. Nearly all were male, and the average age was 34 years old. The study found most shooters shared common traits like experiencing childhood trauma. The researchers also learned these shootings are socially contagious. Psychologist Jillian Peterson is co-founder of the Violence Project. Its findings will be published later in a book, and she joins us now. Jillian, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let me start with this idea of childhood trauma, because people hear that right away and say, red flag, red flag. What did you find out, though, about childhood trauma and these mass shooters?
So we found that it's really a slow build over time. So you do see intense childhood trauma, things like parental suicide, serious physical and sexual abuse, heavy bullying. But then that builds over time. You add in mental health concerns, you add in a real crisis point, and then access to this script for this form of violence and the means to carry it out. And so we do see these common factors, but of course, the majority of people who experience childhood trauma, this is not how it turns out.
Right. Nearly every mass shooter that you studied suffered an identifiable crisis, you say, before the shooting.
Yeah, and that's something we've been really interested in terms of prevention. So in the days, weeks, or months before the shooting, there's a marked change in behavior, and it's typically a suicidal crisis. Mm-hmm. So about 80% we could identify were actively suicidal before they did this. And these really are suicides in essence. They're
yes.
horrific, but the shooter typically dies. And so that change in behavior, people leak their plans. 78% leaked their plans ahead yeah. of time, so people
wow.
knew.
So eight out of 10 gave a warning in effect.
Yes, a very clear warning.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, host of the podcast Crime Analyst and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service. And today we have two very special guests joining us.
Hi, my name is Dr. Jillian Peterson. I'm an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University and co-founder and co-president of the Violence Project.
And I'm Dr. James Densley, and I am a professor of criminal justice at Metropolitan State University in Minnesota, and I'm also a co-founder and co-president of the Violence Project.
We are very pleased to have you back again. We only just touched the surface, really, of the questions that Jim and I have, and it would be great just to dive straight back in and hear the answers that you have to our questions about what happens if majority of the cases that you're talking about, particularly with school shooters, if they are current students, when you're doing drills or when you're talking through what to do and what to expect, well, are you not educating them, or perhaps are you not giving people ideas that might have grievances and then it might escalate their behavior in essence?
Yeah, that's a real concern for us. I think when that early finding that school shooters are insiders, they're vast majority current students, a few former students, but most of the school shooters are students going in and out of these security procedures every day, who know the way the school is set up and who have been going through drill after drill after drill and know the school's exact response and how the school is, what the staff and the students are going to do when they do this. So is it normalizing that type of violence? Is it giving certain vulnerable students ideas? I think is the first concern. And second, there's been cases where perpetrators have used that inside knowledge to actually increase casualties rather than decrease them. Mm. Which is why we've been saying we think it's critically important to train all the adults in the building. You want the teachers, you want the staff, you want every adult to know what to do. But when it comes to drilling the children, when we think about if this happens, it's one of the kids going through those drills, that's where I think we have to take a pause and really think through what we're doing now that we have this data to think about it differently.
In our home state of Minnesota, they run 5 drills, active shooter drills, every single year. And they do it from pre-K all the way through to 12th grade. So if you do the math on that, you're looking at over 70 times you've been told, you might get murdered today. Let's lock down and let's do this. And I'm really concerned about what's that doing to an entire generation of young people. And of course, I say this in my British accent, having gone through the British education system, but I just cannot imagine any other country being okay with that, that would be acceptable as a protocol, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And talk about trauma. I remember when I was a kid, it was, you know, air raid drills, you know, it was, you know, a nuclear bomb's going to drop on us. And that is not something that I was really happy about. I was always scared about it. And I was like, if a nuclear bomb is going to drop on us, how is me crouching under my desk going to protect us? I mean, I don't understand that. It's just a really, really, I don't know, traumatic thing for a little kid in kindergarten, you know, 4 years old, to have to do that. So I can imagine the same thing now with these school shooter or active shooter drills causing the same kind of trauma. And like you said, if it's repeated 70 times, boy, that's a lot of repeated trauma.
Yeah, there's more and more research coming out about how much trauma these drills can cause. And some are worse than others, right? So some, if they're unannounced, if they have live actors, if they have people running around jiggling door handles, making it feel like somebody's really getting in, there are ways that we know drills can cause additional trauma. And there's ways that you can do them and talk students through them that you can make them less traumatic. I have 3 young kids, and I will never forget, I think it was my first grader coming home, and he said they did a drill. And I was asking him about it, and he said he had to sit in the carpet in the middle of the room. And I said, but why are you in the carpet in the middle of the room? And he said, in case bullets fly through the windows. And to me, he wasn't traumatized by it. What to me was so shocking was the nonchalance with which he said that, right? That just, oh, in case bullets come through my windows of my first grade classroom, we have to practice doing this. And what does that do to how he thinks about school and how safe he thinks the world is and how that's shaping kind of his entire worldview is what really struck me.
Wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have guns? I'm just saying.
The assault rifle ban to start with.
You just went there.
I did go there.
You know, it's interesting you say that, right? Because that's when you talk about mass shootings, that is the elephant in the room. And it's always the thorny issue that once you start to grapple with, you know that you're going to get hate mail and some people are not going to like the answers. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we always try and do with this is just stick with the data. Right? The data are the data, and let's be driven by that. And let's try and put to one side the kind of partisan bickering that always comes up when you talk about firearms. And the reality is very, very simple, which is when we look at the lives of mass shooters, there are almost countless examples of individuals who were in a state of crisis. And it was during that time that they purchased the firearm legally, that then they used in the commission of that crime. And so you look at that and you think to yourselves, well, are there things then, loopholes that are in the existing system that need to be addressed that don't infringe on people's Second Amendment rights, but they do get at this idea of now is not the time to be shopping for a firearm when you are showing all these kind of red flags for what is about to be happening. So you've got that, definitely. Secondly, there are lots of examples that we can point to suggest that things like extreme risk protection orders, also known as red flag laws, would be really helpful in taking firearms away from. I mean, Laura, this is really your area of expertise. We've got individuals in our database with histories of domestic abuse and domestic violence. The first person they kill in their mass shooting might be a spouse or a girlfriend. Then they go out into the public place and they kill others, which is how they wind up in our database, because we don't focus exclusively on domestic violence. There has to be more of the public shootings in our case. But there's an example as well. If you've got somebody with a history of domestic violence, could a red flag law have disarmed them before they went and did this crime? I'd mentioned in an earlier episode with you guys about safe storage of firearms and how, particularly for school shooters who are young, they are getting their guns from unsecured locations, parents, grandparents, and so forth. That's another way we could intervene here. And then you also have to look at things like the capacity of magazines and the just the velocity and the ferocity of the weapons that are out there that can be used in these cases. You know, a lot of people talk about assault weapons, for instance, and whether an assault weapon ban would be a good policy. Again, looking at the data, what's interesting is the vast majority of mass shootings are perpetrated with handguns. And any sort of semi-automatic weapon is dangerous, if you get what I'm saying. Many people would say it doesn't really matter, it's just who's using it. But the one thing that's really interesting in our data is, if you look at general homicide in the United States, so everyday murders, you would see that an assault weapon is really used in a very small percentage of those crimes. Sometimes maybe less than 1%. In mass shootings, it's 25%. There's something about the symbolism of that weapon, meaning that when you want to perpetrate a mass shooting, if you're following that violent script that we were talking about, you want it to look like a mass shooting. You're going to follow the script of the others. You're going to use that same weapon that others have done. And unfortunately, they are often these assault rifles. And then secondly, those are weapons that they incite fear, they intimidate others, they fit that script, but they also are incredibly deadly. And so from a mass shooting standpoint, there is something about those weapons that stands out. But in everyday homicides, they don't. So there's just these interesting things when you follow the data that you do start to look at this. And like we mentioned before, opportunity is only one factor in why people go ahead and perpetrate mass shootings. But it is an area where we can intervene. And we have a whole chapter in the book that really goes into detail about all these different policies and practices around firearms, which may or may not be effective, and sort of debunking some of the myths around some of this stuff.
But if they're looking to increase the body count, which we know a lot are, hence the assault rifle makes sense, because in the short amount of time, you get in a target-rich environment, multiple casualties. And I think about Parkland, you know, I was asked to go on CNN International just after that happened, and I agreed if they didn't name the shooter. And when I went on, I said that it sounded to me like he was targeting particular individuals and would imagine that there's a background of domestic violence and or stalking. And the news presenter just looked straight at me and said, "How can you say that, Laura? We don't know that yet." And I said, "Because I understand patterns of behavior." And he chose a particular day, Valentine's Day. That signifies to me that Valentine's Day is meaningful. It wasn't just a random day, particular victims selected on a particular day for a particular reason. And they actually broke the story that between the 9 and 10 o'clock bulletin, they did their research and found out there had been 33 call-outs to his home address, that his mother had called them, firearms, domestic abuse, neighbors were terrified. There were so many points of intervention. The real flag to me where there that signified that there was a history was one of the local law enforcement officers on the news saying immediately in the aftermath, this could not have been prevented, which told me everything. If you have someone saying that right out the gate, when you don't even have time to do the desktop review or know what's there, inadvertently they're saying this is a horror story. And that's exactly what it was. And CNN International broke that. But there were multiple points of intervention. So many people were frightened of him. The school's response, exclude him. Of course, it's like kicking the hornet's nest over. And that weapon in the wrong person's hands. You know, I think about the Santa Barbara shooter where law enforcement look at him and they look at his stature, his demeanor. He's kowtowing. But you put an assault weapon or anything else in his hands, he's a danger. So I think oftentimes it's also who looks like they're a risk. And we get the assessment of dangerousness, threat, and risk wrong repeatedly. Dunblane, you know, what happened pre-Dunblane, what happened post-Dunblane? We don't have this problem in the UK. But I agree with you. It's not one thing that's ever going to solve this. It's so multifaceted and layered of your micro and macro that there's an awful lot of work to do. And yes, I remain hopeful, but it's a huge amount of work at the front line, isn't it, with key leaders that really need to invest and understand why off-ramp and the R model, you know, and I don't know what the uptick is of whether you have that investment, certain states, certain areas that you're working in, or how you roll it out, but I'd certainly be very interested to know.
Yeah, there's a number of things that you just said that were so interesting. So I think the first that struck me was, I think a lot of times when we talk to practitioners in schools and workplaces and HR, we say, this is not a problem you can punish your way out of, right? You can't suspend, expel, you can't fire someone or ask them not to come to work. That doesn't make this problem go away. And in fact, it makes it worse, right? What you've done is intensify their grievance with the school or intensify their grievance with the workplace. And a lot of times you see that that actually is the final straw that causes the crisis that makes them come back and do it. We see that again and again. So when we do have these individuals that we are worried about, that make us uncomfortable, that are threatening, that our instinct is to just say, get them out of here, right? Like, get them out, push them out. We can't keep doing that, right? That's not solving it. So how do we create a system that is really willing to say, okay, how can we help you, right? Like, how can we connect with you? What services do you need? Who can we surround you with? How do we bring you in a way that maybe creates more peer support, makes you less angry, right? How do we do that? And it's a harder sell. I think we're not used to doing that. We think of violence prevention and we think, get people out of here, put up security. But the reality is, with these cases in particular, because they're insiders, violence prevention is really saying, like, here's this person showing all these warning signs that we're really worried about. How do we actually dig in? And that's a different mind frame. It's a shift.
And Laura, you mentioned, so we launched this new initiative as sort of a spin-off with the Violence Project. We called it Off-Ramp. And we worked with a number of partners. You mentioned this multi-agency working that needs to happen with this. So we were in touch with colleagues at the Secret Service. We were in touch with colleagues at the Minnesota School Safety Center, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension here in Minnesota as well, and talking to school leaders. One of the things that we heard, which is really interesting in the current climate, is we want to build threat assessment protocols, particularly for schools, but also for workplaces. But in schools at the moment, there's a real backlash against law enforcement, particularly here in Minnesota in the aftermath of the death of George Floyd, of having a police presence in schools. So one of the things we were hearing is that the concept of threat was actually leading people to sort of say, this is just yet another part of the school to prison pipeline and getting young men of color wrapped up in the criminal justice system. And so we've approached through the Off-Ramp Project a new threat assessment protocol. We're calling it crisis response teams. It's very different when you call somebody and say, your child's in crisis and they need some care, versus your child is a threat and we need to refer them to the threat assessment team. So we've tried to build, you can go on the website, offramp.org, you can download the protocols, you can download fillable forms for the schools that you can build a threat assessment team. We call it a crisis response team. You can be thinking about what we need to do to really provide holistic violence prevention within a school and also within workplaces as well, to do exactly this, to realize that you can't suspend and expel and punish your way out of these problems. You can't just fire somebody and that will be case closed. You actually need to be checking in, seeing what's wrong, getting them connected to the services and resources that they need, and a much more sort of long-term prevention strategy. And the other thing that we've done with the Off-Ramp site is to provide online training for things like crisis intervention, suicide prevention, and so on. Again, just to be a resource, because I think a lot of people are trying to find ways to get their head around this stuff, because it can feel so big and scary and threatening. But if done right, it's actually quite intuitive once it becomes part of the culture of a school or of a workplace. This is something that we're going to invest in order to make sure that we have a better environment to be working and playing in.
Post George Floyd is an interesting context, I think, of putting police officers in schools. So some things that you might have used to go to, actually, you have to rethink. But I wonder how much you believe, and as I do, actually, in terms of intervention and prevention, it's actually the smallest things that seem to make the biggest difference. We're not talking about huge things. We're talking about little micro things that could take somebody off that pathway. Is that something that you found through your research? And if so, what might be, just to give our listeners some of the examples of what some of those things might be?
Yeah, I deeply believe that, actually. I used to work a suicide prevention hotline, right? And people would call when they're thinking about killing themselves. And what's amazing is that it doesn't take that much, right? Like, it's asking questions, it's connecting, it's listening to someone, it's making them feel heard, it's giving them a reason to hope. You don't have to have particular letters behind your name or fancy training or be an official counselor to be able to ask someone how they're doing and carve out 15 minutes to really deeply listen. We talked to principals who were saying, I don't want my shop teacher doing suicide prevention. And we said, you absolutely 100% want your shop teacher to be able to do suicide prevention if that's the wow. person that this kid decides to sort of disclose that to. And there are cases, there's a great YouTube video of a guy who almost did a school shooting. It's a TED Talk. And he talks about how he went over to his friend's house and the mom had baked him a blueberry pie because he was coming over there. And just that act of somebody baking him a pie was enough to get him off the path. Wow. So it feels so massive, but it can be so small.
Yeah. And it's interesting because one of the things I wanted to ask you about was the Las Vegas shooting incident. At the time, I was asked to go on CNN or one of the other shows. And the big thing was that they said, well, there's no motive. This is a motiveless shooting. There's no motive. And I said, I think the motive is fairly clear. This person wanted to kill themselves. And they wanted to do something very big when they went out. It's pretty obvious that there was no exit plan. It's pretty obvious that he knew that he was going to be targeted as soon as he started, right? But, you know, they didn't see that as a motive. But it seems like what you've talked about already, conjoining many of these incidents with suicide, that we know a fair amount about suicide prevention. We've had suicide prevention hotlines for many decades. So this is, again, another hopeful intervention point. What did you study the Las Vegas shooting incident, and what kind of conclusions did you come to with respect to that particular one?
Yeah, Jim, I think you're absolutely right. We see the Vegas shooting as experiential, essentially. It was that this was a suicide, but the intent was to go out with a big bang, essentially. It was very well planned, but you also take that step back and you look at the life of that individual and the way in which they were always sort of thrill-seeking and seeking that high through their gambling behavior and through the way in which they spent their money and other factors. And so it seems that that was where that was pointing to. And as you also said, we know a lot about suicide prevention. So we know when people are at that crisis point, what we need to do to prevent. And it's interesting because we can think about it from that individual level of some of the things Jill was talking about, getting people talking on a suicide prevention hotline, for instance, but also through to the way in which the media covers some of these events. When they cover suicide, they've learned their lesson from famous celebrity suicides about not naming the exact mechanism by which it occurred and not dwelling too much on certain factors because they were worried about copycats. And today now we think about if we applied that same logic to these mass shootings, where at the end of a media article, you would list at the bottom the number for the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, if it was a story about suicide, thinking about, should we be doing the same thing for mass shootings? If you're thinking about violence, call this number. And the way in which we fixate on motive sometimes, it's interesting because in that conversation with the media, you said, you know, they were really interested in, like, let's get to the motive of this. What our research is suggesting and what the book is really emphasizing is sometimes the motive can be a bit of a red herring, because what it does is it explains away the phenomena. So we can say, well, they did this because it was terrorism, or they did this because it was hate, or they did this because they were really angry. And you're like, yes, now we've got the motive. But that doesn't really move us anywhere closer to solving the problem. All that does is enables us to kind of explain it away, put it in a box, and then never have to deal with it again. And instead, sometimes actually putting that to one side and saying, well, yeah, okay, they did it because of their hateful ideology. But how did they get to that hateful ideology in the first place? What got them online looking at these types of websites? What got them searching for someone they could relate to? Why were they tumbling down that rabbit hole to begin with? Because I don't spend my days getting radicalized online because I'm so angry at the world. So you have to sort of take that step back again and think about, where are those intervention points? And I think we can learn a lot from suicide prevention when you think about it from that perspective, and less about the kind of media fixation with motive.
Yeah, I actually think that suicide prevention is probably the key in terms of preventing mass shootings. You don't commit a mass shooting if you want to be alive, right? And so if you just take that, if you're not suicidal, this is not a crime that you're going to commit, because it's basically required that you die in it or you spend the rest of your life in prison. So there's this desperate hopelessness when you do this crime, in addition to that anger and that grievance. I think Vegas is a good example where he's actively suicidal. He was older. He'd lost a lot of his money. He targeted young, happy people having fun in Vegas as sort of the representation of his grievance and who he wanted to take out with him. And we recently published a paper that looked at shootings where there was a school resource officer on site and school shootings where there is not a school resource officer on site. And what we found is that shootings where there was an officer on site had three times the level of casualties as shootings that didn't. And we say, I mean, our thinking is that's because they're suicides, right? That's because that's a student of that school who knows there's a school resource officer there, who goes in essentially looking to be shot by that officer. In many ways, they're suicide by cops, goes in with extra arms because they know that he's there. So again, if you think of these as suicides, it changes that dynamic of that officer isn't going to be as helpful then. So I think what we can learn about prevention with suicide in terms of, you just have to ask questions, you have to be willing to dig in, you have to let air out of the balloon, you have to bring in all extra people, all of those same sort of phenomenon still work in this case.
And the motive is an interesting one, because I do think everyone, it doesn't matter what case you're talking about, actually, but everyone wants to understand that motive. And then unfortunately, we get into, well, it's when X happened that then Y happened. And it looks so simple, doesn't it? And then everyone's like, oh, okay, yeah. So it then becomes one dimensional, rather than getting into everything that went on before. And we know that violence, and we know suicidal ideation, it takes time. It's a pathway. And I think that pathway of us understanding it far better in terms of a timeline is far more helpful. And the Vegas case, I mean, lots of people have asked me about, and sadly, there have been so many cases, haven't there, that even when you say the Vegas case, people may not even know which one you're talking about. But this is the concert case, and I never like to name it by the shooter either. But he was a controlled and controlling individual, and in some ways, it looked very similar to a domestic violence type wipeout of, it ends my way and when I say and how I say. And, you know, the level of premeditation that goes into it, that ideation. I wonder if you have any sense of timeline, not just for that case, but in terms of the premeditation of how long the ideation's there from attitude to action. Because looking at some of your stats, It looks like you say that 87% are in crisis prior, i.e. there are warning signs. 80% are suicidal. 78% leaked plans before. So that's where we've clearly got intervention opportunities if they are leaking it and talking about it. And 50% targeted someone specifically, very highly planned. So I wonder, is there a timeline of sorts in terms of, and I know it's probably quite difficult to say, but I would be interested in that, of the preparation and preparing for it and premeditation aspect.
Yeah, it's one of the big projects we're working on now is actually marrying together the timelines of the individuals in their sort of private personal lives and then the individuals in their public lives. And what we mean by that is their lives on social media. So we're seeing, can we see that if we knew something that happened in their life, so this was the day that they got dumped by their girlfriend, what do they then post on social media at that same time? And you start to see that their attitude changes and that the things they start to post are a little bit darker and a little bit different. And is that then a warning sign of what's going on in the background? So that's actually the kind of next iteration of this research, is that we're really trying to get to that timeline question. But even in the meantime, we do have a sense of these kind of quite detailed timelines for the offenders, where we can go back in time and see where those crisis points were. And in some cases, they had been going on for years. So you did have that slow build over time. And you mentioned it's a sort of a pathway versus it being a profile in that sense, that you can see those trajectories, that they do come. It's not just that something happens on Tuesday and on Wednesday, they go ahead and perpetrate the crime. Sometimes the thing that happened was 2 years ago, but you can slowly start to see that things change in the life of that individual. They stop showing up for work on time, and all of a sudden they're getting fired from work because of this, and the trajectory moves on in that way.
Yeah, and I would say it's certainly not a one-size-fits-all in terms of the timeline. So we have, I think there are some perpetrators who do extensive amount of planning, that they decide they're going to do this, and they can plan for months. I would say those tend to be more school shooters, college, university shooters. And then we have other ones where it has been a slow build over time, but the decision to do this happens really quickly. Sometimes those are workplace shooters where, I mean, there's cases where they go grab the handgun that was in their glove box after they got fired and go in, and it really was not well planned out. We also see that in the case of psychotic shooters, which is about 10% of the perpetrators in our database who are actively responding to hallucinations and delusions, where that might have in a bit come out of the blue. So I think there are well-planned and there are not well-planned, and they have these kind of different trajectories.
Wow. That's a whole spectrum of behaviors, and we should have prepared a whole spectrum of responses and intervention. So this is so very helpful. Can you tell our listeners when your book is coming out and how they can get it?
It is available now, pretty much anywhere they sell books.
So Amazon. All the physical bookstores?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Barnes & Noble, Amazon, you name it, they're all there. And the book is called The Violence Project. And then the subtitle is How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic.
Excellent. I was just about to do the title for everybody as we dived straight in and we didn't name it at the beginning. So yes, do go out and buy copies. I think it's really interesting. I mean, the 360 aspect where you've spoken to so many people, and this has been, what, 3 years in the works?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, we're nearly pushing four now. It was 2017. In that summer. So we are at 4 years where we kind of first started thinking about this work. And then it was when we got the funding from the National Institute of Justice. That was in 2018 that we really were able to accelerate the work, because that's what really enabled us to literally fly around the country, spending time with these victims and first responders and survivors and conducting those interviews. The pandemic slowed us down a little bit, but then we just reverted to Zoom like the rest of the world and kept those interviews going. So it has been a 3 or 4 year project. And wow, we're very excited to share it all with the world.
Well, I can't wait to read the book. And also, every time I get asked to respond on one of these news programs, I will certainly reference it. And I'm sure Laura will as well, because this is something that we've been waiting for. It's really interesting, the statistics that you talked about, having a school resource officer at the school actually increases the death toll. And that's, you know, incredibly saddening to hear. But the data is telling us something, that if these people, as Laura said, if they're in the school and they know the school's response because of these training exercises, then you're actually giving them a blueprint on how to get around the security and make it worse. So that's really important. That's a very, very important aspect, because I think, you know, a lot of people advocate that, well, we just need to arm more teachers and we just need to get more guns in the hands of good people. The problem is that seemingly good people, and actually good people, can have a crisis point that trips a switch and they become violent. And that, unfortunately, is not detectable, you know, when they're going out and buying a weapon. So, or they could buy the weapon days, months, weeks, years, decades beforehand, or it could be in their family. And you can't predict that this will happen at some point. So it's just a very, very interesting statistic. And I'm sure there'll be many more usable facts that everybody from, you know, school groups to youth groups to administrators and also employers. And I know a number of professionals who do threat assessments. I'm sure they too will be able to use it to help actually give more accurate threat assessments, but also, more importantly, suggest interventions that will reduce the reaction of these potential shooters.
We very much hope so. We just want anyone who has been touched by this issue to engage in this and think differently about it is really the goal, to just move us a little bit closer toward that prevention goal.
And I have many more questions, but one in particular, just of you interviewing survivors and first responders, but survivors first of all, was there anything that jumped out at you in terms of what they had to share around intervention and prevention and their experience?
I would say one of the things that I think really we saw consistently was there are elements of sort of survivor's guilt that people are really processing. And there's the terrible trauma of these events. I mean, a mass shooting fractures the fabric of that community and it changes and transforms everybody's lives. It's not just the 2, 3, 4 people who are in the immediate proximity. It's an entire community that has been devastated by those things. And so there was a lot of trauma. There was a lot of heartbreak and heartache that in the interviews really were part of that process. The other thing as well is that they mentioned you become part of this club that no one wants to be a member of. But at the same time, there are these support networks across the country. And there's research that calls them survivor networks, which I think is a really great way of putting it, where you have survivors who are finding a sort of new lease of life in one another, and then a new sense of purpose in the tragedy, that in some cases they then use that to go into advocacy work or go into policy and to try and change this so that it never happens again. So there were some really inspiring stories that we encountered during the course of this work, that once you got through the sort of the trauma and the heartache of the actual event, the way it kind of galvanized the way they saw the world and wanted to make a difference was just totally inspiring. And I think it has really changed Jill and I's lives, actually, I think we are different people today than we were 3 or 4 years ago when we first started this project. And it's because of the time we spent with those interviewees that they shape your worldview and they make you see the world very, very differently. And that's been a really powerful part of the research project.
I would also just add that because shooters are insiders, a lot of the survivors knew the perpetrators beforehand. So whether it was their school teacher or their classmate, or they were their boss, they saw the buildup and then they lived through the horrific event. And now they can sort of think about it in this way where they have so much insight that other people don't, in terms of, were there warning signs, right? Were they surprised at who it was? Could they have ever imagined this happening? And so we learned a lot from those survivors who had known the perpetrator ahead of time in terms of what those warning signs and crisis points look like.
I bet. I mean, that actually mirrors Amy's experience, Amy Over, when she was talking with us, the survivor's guilt that she felt, and in particular, people's response to her after she survived, not treating her as a survivor or a victim. Well, you weren't shot, you weren't injured, as if the psychological trauma, everything that she experienced didn't count and wasn't valid. And so that secondary trauma that she experienced, and now many years later, I mean, her trauma actually came up when she was taking her first child to school, and it all reappeared, and she couldn't understand why at that point in her life it all came up for her, and she was triggered. And that guilt that she feels and still searching for answers, one of the key questions that she had, because in that case there was a list of people being targeted, was she on the list? She had to know. And many years later, you know, she had to know. So her podcast is very much her journey. And I think it's probably all the things that you have found, but we're hearing it step by step, her going back to the school, speaking to the teachers, the first responders, some of the incredible survivors who, like you say, James, they're now actually doing first response work of helping others identify the signs and off-ramp people. They're not using similar terminology, but it's exactly the same ethos in many senses. They've gone on to do incredible things, but others who haven't done so well and have pushed their trauma down, and some who have ended up in prison for domestic violence and now have insight further down the line about what happened to them wasn't causal, but it push them down a bit different path. And now they're helping people too. So everyone's journey has been quite different, but I think it's a very interesting, unique perspective in a podcast form of taking you step by step through a historical event, which has obviously changed the lives of so many people. And others have set up charities to share their experience and help others too. And I love the fact that you said, James, that you feel that you're a different person actually from doing the work, and hopefully I'm sure for the better, in terms of it, when we speak to survivors and we understand, we can't always stand in their shoes, but we see a very different perspective. And I think oftentimes with research, it's missed the victim, the survivor's voice, their journey, some of them through to thriving and going on and doing incredible things, helping others from such a traumatic and horrific experience and life event. There can be some silver linings and some fantastic things that come out of it.
Yeah, it's the strength and the resilience and everything that you get encountered to. And I think we have felt that we feel very privileged to be holding those stories. And we're now very excited to be able to share some of them with the world, with the book. And as I said, it's a real privilege actually to be in those spaces with those people, to hear how they've navigated their lives and how they're kind of making sense of what has become the defining moment of their lives in many ways. And then being able to try and use that information so we can prevent that others don't have to go through those same things as well. It was just so important.
We're really so excited about the work that you've done, and man, so thankful. It's a great thing to know that somebody is actually doing something about the things that as a country, I think we have gotten fairly complacent. Each time there is a horrific shooting, there's sort of a complacent and accepting response that it just happened and, you know, wow, it's just happened again. And nobody's actually doing anything. And there's a whole bunch of lobbyists and there's political things that go on. And there's also the conspiracy theorists that say they're faked. And that's probably one of the most traumatic things that could happen to the victims' families and the survivors, is to have people literally just with absolutely no proof or reason belittle or try to say that it didn't actually happen. And I hope that people will understand that this study, the data in this study, will help to prove that not only did these horrific events happen, but that with some planning and a little bit of effort and everybody joining together, we can prevent many of these from happening in the future. So thank you so much, James and Jill. And we hope to see you back again soon.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
So we still have many questions to ask of you both, and we would love to bring you back at once the book has been born into the world. And I highly recommend to our listeners, please do take a look at the book. Please buy it, The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. And as James and Jill said, you can buy it everywhere and anywhere. So you can pre-order and from September the 7th. So a really important book, one that I can't believe it's taken so long really for us to have a book like this. And the fact it took some time for you to be funded, that also paints a picture, because thoughts and prayers are not enough. And having data-driven solutions, evidence-based solutions, but through the people who it has impacted and affected, is so important. So thank you so much for sharing so much time with us and being so generous with your time. I know our listeners will really enjoy these episodes. Enjoy is probably the wrong word. It's a very dark and difficult subject, but I think you bring light to it and hope. And I think that's a very important thing for people to know, that these are preventable. We can work with people. There doesn't have to be this finality point. So thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your wisdom and your evidence. And for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
The Case of Sally Challen, The Teacher's Pet, Lynette Dawson, The Exonerated Five and When They See Us, and The Disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 200 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.